Welcome to Our Curious Amalgam, the weekly podcast brought to you by the Antitrust Law Section of the American Bar Association. Our Curious Amalgam explores the fascinating and increasingly overlapping world of competition, consumer protection, data protection, and privacy law. Each week, we bring you leading global experts on the most compelling issues of the day. Enjoy the show.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Our Curious Amalgam. I'm Sergey Soslovsky, and the title of today's episode is Too Political or Not Political Enough? A debate on the relationship between antitrust enforcement and democracy. There are a lot of debates about antitrust policy today. The one that may be the most fundamental is whether antitrust essentially is an economic policy, or does antitrust play a significant role in preserving our democratic political values as well? For instance, is there any connection between economic power and political power? And if so, when we talk about market concentration, should we only worry about economic efficiency, or should we also be concerned about the effects it has on our political institutions and our democracy? And today we have a real special treat for our listeners, not just one guest, but two distinguished thinkers with very different viewpoints on this important issue. So hope you're ready for a good debate. And joining me today is Melissa Maxman. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Sergey.
Why don't you introduce our guests and kick off the debate?
Will do. So I am honored and delighted and pleased to be able to introduce two of the scholars that I admire the most in antitrust. First, Jeffrey Manney is president and founder of the International Center for Law and Economics, or ICLE, which is a nonprofit partisan research center based in Portland, Oregon. He's also a distinguished fellow at the Northwestern University's Center on Law, Business, and Economics. Next, but not least, is my longtime and dear friend, Spencer Weber Waller. Spencer is the John Paul Stevens Chair in Competition Law and Director of the Institute for Consumer Antitrust Studies and a professor at Loyola University Chicago School of Law, where he teaches antitrust, intellectual property, civil procedure, and international litigation courses. In 2022, Professor Waller served as a senior advisor to the chair of the Federal Trade Commission. Welcome to both of you. So let's get started. Spencer and Jeff, I believe you each prepared opening statements. Spencer, why don't you start?
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you, Sergey. It's great to be here. So with respect to the issue at hand, I have five basic points, and I hope we have time to chat about as many of them as possible. First is that the antitrust laws were intended and always understood to be the economic embodiment of the concepts of separation of powers and the checks and balances that are found in our Constitution for the political sphere. And antitrust plays the same role in promoting a multiplicity of voices and no monopoly over power in the economic sphere, the same way our Constitution does in the political sphere. Second, that a commitment to a democratic vision of antitrust means that the fundamental policy decisions are made by the branches of government most directly connected to the people. Third, a commitment to a democratic vision of antitrust also means a focus on controlling the economic power of actors that can harm the political as well as economic markets. Fourth, the rule of law requires that the antitrust agencies and the courts should enforce and interpret the antitrust laws as enacted by Congress. When I talk about the antitrust laws, I mean all of them, and not pick and choose according to the individual policy preferences. And yes, that includes statutes like the Federal Trade Commission Act, the Robinson-Patman Act, Packers and Stockyards Act, all of them. And then if time permits, I also would be delighted to discuss competition systems outside the United States that I think also recognize the role of antitrust in preserving both economic freedom and political freedom.
Thank you, Spencer. Jeffrey, do you want to give us your opening statement?
Sure. Thanks. Thanks, Melissa. Thanks, Sergey. And delighted to be here with Spencer. Always a great sparring partner, and I'm sure that we'll have a great time today too. I think there are two conceptions of democracy that are most relevant here. The one is the political one, equating democracy with majoritarian political decision making. And then I think there's a broader one, connecting democracy with individual autonomy or self-governance. And because antitrust is concerned with the excessive exercise of market power, I think it's said to relate to democracy in two ways. First, influencing political outcomes to benefit the economically powerful at the expense of the majority. And two, undermining market competition to give economic power to the few at the expense of the individual autonomy of the many. Now, I think there are problems with both of these as a basis for taking account of democracy in antitrust. First, the connection between economic power and political power is weak. It's not the case that more concentrated economic power, the more influence on political outcomes. It turns out that, for better or worse, it's pretty cheap to influence politics, and small companies, labor unions, trade groups, college buddies, activists, they can all do it just as well as large firms. And second, the remedy for excessive economic power is more political power. But excessive political power isn't necessarily democratic either. And I'd say that goes doubly when, as seems most common today, the push for more democratic antitrust seems to entail increasing the power of the least democratic parts of government, executive agency, rulemaking, and enforcement. It's also not clear to me how the idea of democracy is really operationalizable in a way that provides an intelligible basis to change the distribution of economic power in markets. On the one hand, antitrust without any explicit incorporation of democracy already aims to preserve market competition and limits the wielding of excessive economic power. Not sure what a focus on democracy would change there. I don't think there's anything in the current regime that's facially inconsistent with democratic processes. On the other hand, I think some people are concerned that, in fact, the distribution of power that results from a competitive market is something that they find distasteful and inconsistent with democracy. Now, in that case, the concern isn't really with preserving competition, but with designing markets in some other image preferred by certain political elites, and that's hardly democratic. And I think this would absolutely open the door to more exercise of political power, inevitably in ways inconsistent with democracy.
Thanks, Jeff. Spencer, I know that's a lot to unpack. And so what we have planned is to kind of break it down into various aspects of what you each had to say. So let's start with the history of antitrust law. What do you think the history of antitrust tells us about the connection between antitrust and democracy? And should we care about what history has to teach us?
I think we should care deeply. And I think we have a plethora of history that we could take all day. I'll do the best I can to sum this up briefly. And I'm relying a lot on a terrific series of books that Barry Hawk, the Fordham law professor, Skadden partner, has put together on monopoly in America and the history of monopoly more generally. And so, if we go back far enough, literally the earliest North American settlements and eventually the colonies were all the property of English and Dutch proprietary trading companies. These political entities were literally the private property of an economic entity. And this produced reactions from the colonies as early as 1641. Massachusetts barred monopolies being granted or allowed among us. William Penn sought to have a monopoly and was unsuccessful. Eventually, these trading companies fell apart and were followed by English mercantilistic trading monopolies that had exclusive import and export rights, limitations on domestic manufacturing. This produced, among other things, the American Revolution, the fervor against the Tea Act, the monopoly of the East India Company, the Boston Tea Party as an anti-monopoly protest. The English monopolies were one of many things mentioned in the Declaration of Independence as the injuries and usurpations of King George that demanded independence of the colonies. During the War of Independence, there were food riots and acts of violence against monopolizers and more peaceful boycotts and embargoes on English imports. Our founding fathers were concerned about monopoly. Several of the states, the early states, had anti-monopoly clauses in their state constitutions. And indeed, figures as diverse as Madison, Hamilton, and Jefferson all agreed about concerns relating to monopoly. And Jefferson unsuccessfully sought an anti-monopoly clause in the Constitution. And early cases that we read in con law, Gibbons versus Ogden, Charles River Bridge, and the whole fight over the Second Bank of the United States are all monopoly controversies of one sort or another, as are the slaughterhouse cases. And I'm told by other scholars who've researched this that there are 20-some state constitutions that reference monopoly, anti-monopoly today. And the founders of the Sherman Act talked I enjoy sparring with Jeffrey. We often agree at a high level and then disagree how this all gets operationalized. But I mean, the record indicates that Sherman had this glowing language about how if we're not going to endure a king as a political power, we should not endure a king over production and transportation and sale of the necessities of life. Thurman Arnold made the connection between antitrust and democracy to sell his technocratic but pro-enforcement vision of antitrust at a time that the United States was gearing up for war, and eventually for World War II. John Harlan, the elder, spoke in dissent, analogizing the antitrust laws that if we were not going to tolerate human slavery, we weren't going to equally tolerate economic slavery either. So there is a long tradition that makes this link, and I don't think anybody disputes that historically. I think the interesting questions are how we operationalize it, and we're going to talk about that as well.
Okay. So, Jeff, to kick it over to you, Spencer predicted that nobody disputes the historical description. So I guess the first question is, do you have a reaction to the historical description that Spencer provided? And the other question is, do you think the focus should be on what the founding fathers and the framers of the antitrust laws intended, or should we focus instead more on whether there is reason to believe that economic power can damage democracy based on what we know today?
Yeah, I don't think I disagree with the with the history. I think there's an important element that was left out of what Spencer said, that the vast majority of the things described, the trading companies, mercantilism, the issues with the at issue with the Boston Tea Party, all of these anti-monopoly controversies were controversies around government-granted monopolies. And I don't at all disagree that there's a big concern with government intervening in markets and how that might affect democracy and, of course, lots of other things. And so it's sort of consistent with my point, which is the real concern, if you're looking for a sort of a culprit who might be curtailing democracy out there, it's far more likely to be an unfettered and unprincipled government entity. It may be co-opting businesses to do so, but I would say it's the government that is of more concern, and I think that's very clearly what the sort of description of the history that Spencer mentioned shows. Now, that may change a little bit when you get to the Sherman Act, but then, and this goes to your second question, Sergey, then the problem is we don't really know what the framers of the Sherman Act intended. There's a lot of ambiguity, as there always is in legislative history. I always think it's interesting to hear people sort of take an originalist sort of bent to the antitrust laws when in lots of other contexts they would suggest that doing so was anti-democratic. But what we do know is that the one thing that we do know is that the structure that was implemented under the Sherman Act is one where Congress enacted very broad standards like unfair trade and later substantially lessened competition and left it to the courts to figure out the details. That, to me, seems extremely sensible and autonomy-preserving sort of approach. The common law-like mechanism that we've operated under allows the law to evolve as society and understandings of economics evolve. It refrains from imposing top-down prescriptions that, if you get them wrong, are very difficult to change. And they're, of course, imposed on everyone instead of through evolving case-by-case process. If that's what's meant by the sort of democratic elements of, let's say, the Sherman Act, I'm completely on board. But I don't think it's very clear at all notwithstanding grandiose statements by Senator Sherman, that there was an inherent sense that the antitrust laws were important to preserving either of those sort of elements of democracy I mentioned at the outset, either restraining economic power from influencing political power, or sort of restraining economic power from undermining individual autonomy and the like.
Spencer, what is your reaction to that?
Yeah, briefly, Jeffrey's not wrong that the Sherman Act did several things. It federalized existing common law. It criminalized it. And it created both a form of government enforcement as well as private enforcement. Where we disagree is a couple of things. One is, just because much of it is common law doesn't mean that courts just get to do, and again, the least democratic branch, get to do what they think is a good idea, untethered from what Congress meant or what Congress said, because Congress reacted in horror to the rule of reason as they understood the Supreme Court in Standard Oil, and they passed a Clayton Act, and they passed an FTC Act, and later on they passed the Seller-Kefauver Act, and they were doing this to provide, first, some specific practices that they were concerned about, second, to make sure that certain things would be legal if there was a tendency to cause substantial lessening of competition, and third, to create an expert body that was explicitly given the power to develop the meaning of unfair methods of competition as they evolved in the economy. And even if you enjoy and primarily view antitrust as common law, there's different ways to approach that. One of them is this very thoughtful approach that Judge Taft did in Addison Pipe, where he scrupulously examined the common law of something like 17 states and 5 or 6 foreign countries, and viewed himself as bound by that, and not the later Scalia approach, which was to say, I don't care what Congress said, I don't even care what they meant, and he never particularly liked legislative history. Here's what I think is a good idea, and even though somebody else thought it was different a while ago, doesn't bind us now because that's common law. That's not a principled view of the common law. And if we had more judges who approached Taft way of looking at this, I'd have less concern. But Congress has spoken, and when they speak, judges should be policy takers, not policy makers, is one of the arguments for how a more democratic antitrust would play out.
Jeff, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to that. And also, moving past history, what are your views on whether the evidence, as we know today, points towards a connection between economic power and democracy? I want to get into that as well. So,
I think the characterization, Spencer, of the extent of the constraints imposed by Congress on the courts, and the idea that it's sort of just a renegade Justice Scalia who changed that structure, I don't think that's accurate. I think the Congress has, subsequent to the adoption of the Sherman Act, adopted other statutes that clarify aspects of the Sherman Act. But it's also adopted statutes like the HSR Act that makes clear that the merger law should protect commerce and not deter or impede consummation of the vast majority of mergers and acquisitions. And the 1975 amendments to the Sherman Act, which you know, in their direct operation, did something I think was stupid. We're done for the purpose of, the explicit purpose was to amend the Sherman Act to provide lower prices for consumers. And, you know, you can debate whether that's a clear ringing endorsement of the consumer welfare standard or not, but I mean, it's closer to the consumer welfare standard than anything else. And I mean, the notion that the sort of economic content of the antitrust laws is inevitable. And whether it was explicitly intended at the outset when they passed the Sherman Act or not, it's inevitable because it's always been there from the very early decisions, including, of course, the Standard Oil decision. And then, you know, subsequently, I don't think it was made up by Bork or Scalia. I mean, the other thing I wanted to say about that is that I don't see why that's inherently sort of anti-democratic. With respect to Sergey's question about the influence of economic power on political power, the evidence just isn't there to support it. I mean, at one level, it's there. We all know that if you have economic power, you may have access to resources to influence politics. But it turns out not that much money is spent on influencing politics. And the studies that have looked at both lobbying expenditures and campaign contributions have had a really hard time finding any kind of correlation between the size of business or the concentration or market power of business and the amount of money spent on lobbying and also on campaign contribution. Unfortunately, it's really hard to observe outcomes. So we have to assume that more money equals more influence. That's not necessarily the case. And it's possible that firms with excess market power are capable of spending less money and having more influence on outcomes. But no one has demonstrated that. No one has shown that that's actually the case. But I think the really interesting thing about it is that I think that whole discussion has the direction of causation reversed. The problem is a government that is extracting political rents. It is, in Fred McChesney's words, the notion of rent extraction. The problem is not that businesses, whether large or small, are paying to influence politics. It's that politics is set up to extract that money from them, to essentially force them to make payments in order to avoid the threat of or the actual enactment of onerous and damaging regulations. And I mean, whether you think it's clear the causation goes one way or the other, the fact of the matter is the influence of money on politics is a combined problem of those who are doing the influencing and those who are accepting the money to be influenced. And you can't just point to the government and say it's inherently more democratic than market institutions. That's a perfect example where nominally democratic government structures are operating in a way that I think we would say is very undemocratic. I don't think reducing the size of corporations or the power of corporations is going to change that. I think then we're looking at the wrong target. We're aiming at the wrong target if we think the best way to preserve democracy is to shrink the size of companies or the amount of relative economic power they have. There's always going to be demand by politicians for economic payoffs, and I don't think it matters whether the companies paying are super large or just large. And even the smallest companies have a lot of money to give to politicians.
Okay. Spencer, let's kick it to you. I want to hear you respond, first of all, more on the institutional point that you guys have been debating.
Yeah.
What is it about the concern for democracy that would lead you to think that we should do something differently about the roles of the different branches of government with respect to antitrust policy? And then we can also get into the other issue Jeff raised as well. But let's start with an institutional one.
Sure. Listening to Jeffrey, I think he's half right. Jeffrey's afraid of government tyranny, as am I. I'm also afraid of private tyranny. And I have always understood, and maybe not everybody views it this way, but I've always understood the enterprise of antitrust to be an exercise in political economy. And it's not worth debating whether it's political or economic. It's both. You know, it's not taste great, less filling. It's both. And so, that's how I approach it. And I'm equally worried about government tyranny, and I'm equally worried about tyranny from private economic actors. And this goes back to the legal realists, you know, who really talked about if you're getting evicted from your house from, you know, not paying your utilities, it doesn't really matter versus being evicted for not paying your taxes. You're still being evicted, and the consequences are the same. And they were theoreticians who were trying to explain why the public-private divide isn't a meaningful legal concept. But they were onto something, that the abuse of power is bad. I'm sort of adjacent to the neo-Brandeisian movement, but not both feet in that camp, in part because size alone doesn't particularly bother me. I am focused on the abuse of power, and I'm equally concerned about the abuse of private power as I am about government tyranny. As to the specifics of what Jeffrey was talking about lobbying, I think it cuts the other way. I think the general notions of public choice theory are that smaller groups of more powerful people who are more deeply affected by something are better at lobbying than larger, more diffuse groups of people who have less skin in the game. And that, you know, the whole idea of collective action problems prevents groups of small consumers to effectively lobby their interests against small concentrated industry people or a single firm that is approaching a monopoly.
To get us to the institutional question, I was going to ask how you think a focus on democracy can navigate between what you admit are the sort of two poles of the problem. There's economic power that can be the problem. There's political power that can be the problem. But if you're looking at antitrust, the only way antitrust mitigates economic power, I would argue, is to increase political power. So how do you know that you're not increasing political power to such an extent that it is actually the more significant harm or threat to democracy, even though you might be mitigating the threat from economic power?
So, you know, what I would say is this. Fundamental decisions about how markets are going to be regulated should be done by the most democratic branches of government, which is mostly the legislature. And when the legislature speaks in a way that's understandable and coherent, it should be respected by the executive branch and administrative agencies with also the caveat that Congress can, under the current system, delegate the authority for administrative agencies to be the experts to interpret the meaning of certain statutes that they want them to enforce. So I think administrative agencies are acting democratically when they follow those delegations, unless and until the Supreme Court says that's constitutionally impermissible. And I think that the executive branch needs to also respect, and the courts need to respect, when Congress has spoken. Arguably, tying is illegal under four different statutes. One is Section 1 of the Sherman Act because it's an agreement. The other is Section 2 because it can be a form of monopoly maintenance or conceivably attempted monopoly. There's Section 3 of the Clayton Act that bars tying for commodities where it has a tendency to substantially lessen competition. And it can be addressed as an unfair method of competition. And there's some specialties like the Bank Tying Act and a bunch of other things. The Supreme Court deviates from a normal, ordinary democratic role when it says five different textual approaches to a problem all mean the same thing, and that means the rule of reason because they have a economic-based ideological predilection toward a rule of reason, case-by-case balancing approach to this problem. And, you know, in my view, that's not respectful to the democratic institution that has spoken on this issue. And if they want to change that, Congress is free to do so. And Congress can pass smart laws and dumb laws. And, if they want to establish a rule of reason to it entirely and preempt the courts from doing this, you and I might be in there are testifying as to what we think is a better idea. But I believe that that's the place where fundamental issues with respect to the meaning of the antitrust laws is best based, as opposed to a system where the Supreme Court or the agencies, through their actions or inactions, get to make those decisions in lieu of Congress.
So to push our discussion a little more towards the operationalization part of the question, Spencer, it sounds like your suggestion is the agencies should hew more closely to explicit text of statutes. Is there anything else that you would recommend, you know, if you were in charge of the antitrust agencies or if you were in Congress and if you got to, you know, implement reforms that in your view would bring our antitrust policy closer to what you see as part of its goal of promoting democracy? What else would you suggest that we should do?
I would suggest the following, because agencies, even though we have hundreds of lawyers that enforce antitrust and economists that enforce the antitrust laws at the FTC and the Department of Justice, resources aren't unlimited, and any agency under any regime has to set priorities. I would suggest that the priorities relate to which enforcement actions will most effectively constrain the abuse of power, either by a single firm where it does have power in a normal sense of the word, or firms acting collectively. And I can give an example. In the past, the FTC brought a case called Superior Trial Court Lawyers that focused on an agreement by non-unionized court-appointed counsel to refuse to take cases in the District of Columbia until their rates were raised from something like $20 an hour for in-court and certain out-of-court functions that affected both the ability to represent criminal defendants and make a living. And I don't particularly disagree that this was per se illegal. The Supreme Court, I think, got it right as a matter of antitrust law. I question the prioritization of such beating up on the helpless and the hapless, or even more recent cases that went after agreements of minor significance relating to ice skating coaches, church organists, and music teachers. These are not the powerful in our society that can abuse economic markets or, for that matter, political markets. I'd rather see the agencies focus on things that matter. I'd also rather, in the Section 2 area, cartels of significance and mergers that matter. And again, I'm not talking about the dollars involved, although sometimes they may be large, but they may be large and important because they reflect the abuse of power. And those are the ones that I would prioritize, and I would deprioritize the others. The other example I would give very quickly is if the agencies, whichever agency, probably the DOJ, because this is likely to be criminal, if there was a cartel for yacht brokers or jet airplane leasing that raised the price of super yachts to the billionaires and the oligarchs of the world, is it per se? Yeah, it's per se. It's not a good thing. If in a world of unlimited resources, bring the case. But if you're deciding what to do, I'm suggesting in a world where the people that are affected can take care of themselves through contract negotiation, their own buying power, and their ability to bring private rights of action, that's probably enough. And I'd rather see the United States and other agencies around the world focus on cartel enforcement in that space, involving the necessities of life that affect people of limited power and limited economic means relating to food, fuel, transportation, construction equipment, other sorts of things of that nature. So that's how I would, as a matter of sort of prosecutorial discretion, which is unavoidable, make the law more democratic and more focused on the abuse of power. But again, not specifically size or lack thereof.
So I agree with you, of course, that discretion is inevitable. And I think elections have consequences, and the elected officials who appoint the enforcers who get to exercise their discretion should exercise their discretion in whatever fashion they want, as long as it doesn't violate the law. I don't think there's anything we can do about that, even if we wanted to. What I did hear you to be saying, though, especially when you suggested that it's not about dollars involved, for example, it's about they should undertake enforcement actions based on what they think will have the best payoff for democracy or reduce of abuse of power, which might mean focus on, let's say, media mergers over oil mergers or something like that. And where you said that, you also seem to suggest, you're pretty content with the basic structure that we have currently, which is one in which we have certain standards being expressed by Congress, and they are largely enforced by executive agencies and also by private actors, of course, private plaintiffs as well, of course. But what I hear in what you're saying is basically we should give them more discretion. Now, you may not actually be saying that, but I think it's hard to think about a move away from a narrowly economic interpretation of the law to one that looks at something that's inherently more vague, like stopping abuses of power, where you think those abuses of power will be the most harmful. It's impossible to see that as doing anything other than expanding the discretion of what I think we agreed were the least democratic branch. Well, you think the courts are the least democratic. I would say the executive agencies are the least democratic. And that's where I think we really part company, again, because I'm more concerned about government interference in the marketplace. The last thing I would want to see, if our concern, even on the terms of the debate here, where we're concerned with democracy, the last thing I think would help that would be expanding the discretion of those entities to act. I think also the more you do that, there's some sort of meta issues too. The more restrictive, the stricter antitrust law is, the more you're going to induce companies to engage in political influence to try to avoid the application of those laws. So in this, I think Potofsky made this point years ago, you are inviting the influence of economics into the political sphere by exercising discretion that can potentially be influenced by money or friendship or whatever else it is. And I don't think that's beneficial for democracy at all. I actually think that while we're probably in agreement that the basic structure works as is, no, I don't think anyone here is saying that there's something inherently illegal about any of the elements of the process, whether it's agencies acting or the way Congress has acted or the way courts act. We may disagree about exactly how they're acting, but exactly how much they're acting or on which margins. But there's nothing inherently undemocratic about the structure. It is just, to me, a question of how much discretion you want to allow. And so, I mean, my answer to the question you would ask, Sergey, would be, the only thing I think we should change is curtailing the discretion of executive agencies. And I'm glad the court seems to be in the process of doing that right now with, Axon and AMG, West Virginia versus EPA. I think there's a real concern in the court right now, and some of these have been 9-0 opinions, this is not just the right wing of the court, about the exercise of discretion by administrative agencies. If that's where we think there's a democracy deficit, then I think I'm completely on board.
Well, I think we've gotten to the part where we've articulated some of the differences between us. but let me respond. I'm deeply concerned of the grab of power by the Supreme Court, because it's shown no respect or little respect, depending on the specific antitrust issue, for when Congress speaks. And tying is just one example. But I also think that the inevitable discretion of agencies does not mean you get to ignore entire categories of law that you just happen to think are less appropriate, but Congress nonetheless has on the books. And
you have to.
40
you, I mean,
years.
There's always going to be.
One second, yeah. Jeffrey. For 40 years, the agencies haven't brought Robinson-Patman Act cases, but they've also not brought other kinds of things as well. And the current agencies are starting to bring some of those back. And, Melissa and I have each spent time in U.S. Attorney's office. And the idea that, you would sit around and go, wire fraud, why do we want to do that? That's economically inefficient. Some of the things that they do really aren't that bad. That's not how people talk. And in the antitrust sphere, it's as if these laws don't matter. And if, I got no problem institutionally, I would oppose you and explain why in another forum, why I don't want the Robinson-Patman Act to be, reversed. But if Congress wants to do it, that's the place to do it. It's not because the political appointees in an executive branch agency or an independent agency are convinced that it's just a bad idea. It's not how it works. They'll be like the IRS deciding criminal tax fraud isn't a good idea.
As you pointed out, there are constraints of money and time such that discretion is necessarily going to be exercised. And if, as you also pointed out, you thought the concern should be that you exercise your discretion to deal with the largest abuses of power, that's both of those things existing are wholly consistent with not enforcing the Robinson-Patman Act very often or even potentially at all, because they're doing other things. It's not like they're sitting there doing nothing. Meanwhile, private actors have been enforcing the Robinson-Patman Act all along. And so it's not like you don't actually have enforcement of it. I don't see why that's not sort of the optimal outcome. I mean, I agree. Well, you don't agree. I would rather see it repealed. And absolutely, I think that would be better. And there is a, you know, a problem, given that the law is on the book, it should be enforced. But given that you can't enforce every antitrust law against every potential instance in which it's being violated, I don't know how you would demonstrate that the lack of enforcement at the federal by federal enforcement agencies of Robinson-Patman, coupled with the existence of enforcement by private parties and the existence of other enforcement priorities that they're undertaking, isn't perfectly consistent with the regime that you'd like to see.
Well, with that, I am going to interrupt and move on. Not because I agree with you, Jeffrey, having been a federal prosecutor myself, but because we're running out of time. And here's where we get to the more humanizing part of our dialogue. I'm going to ask each of you the same question, and I'm going to ask Jeffrey first because he wants to talk. Tell us something about you that we wouldn't know if we only knew you professionally.
Okay. I have been to, I believe the number is 82, but it might be 84, Phish shows by concerts by the band Phish. Since my first show in 1993 at Wolf Trap in July 13th, I think it was.
That's impressive.
Are you into other jam bands or into the Grateful Dead or anything like that, or just a Phish head?
Of course, I love the Grateful Dead. Unfortunately, I was born too late to see nearly as many Dead shows. I think I made it to 8 Grateful Dead shows. I've gone to see the Allman Brothers quite a bit, Widespread Panic, Blues Traveler, but Phish dramatically more than any others. In fact, my friend and I were my sort of concert buddy and I were imagining the other day if we had all that time that we spent on Phish to had used it to explore other bands, how much, you know, wider, I mean, my musical tastes are extraordinarily wide, but how much even wider they would be. But it was quite enjoyable. And also, much to my parents' chagrin, it's how I spent every New Year's, every holiday at New Year's, I was in New York or New England seeing Phish, and so never at home for holidays.
Well, I'm glad you clarified that, because when you first said Phish shows, I thought of like fly fishing. Spencer, how about you? What's something we wouldn't know about you?
Oh, a couple things. On the musical taste, I'm probably more heavy metal than jam band, but I appreciate a good
Phish.
I'm
with you there, though.
Phish, and I never had a chance to see Phish at Grateful Dead or Wilco, even though it's a hometown band. I've seen The Who 5 or 6 times. I've seen Clapton 5 or 6 times. What people probably don't know is I've also seen the musical Hamilton 8 or 9 times and the musical Rent 14 times.
You left out Paul McCartney, Spencer.
Well, I did attend a Paul McCartney concert with one of the two co-hosts of this podcast.
Well, you know, Spencer, on that last point, another thing unknown about me is that I've done musical theater and all theater since I was in, I guess, 6th grade. And although I have not been in Hamilton, I have seen Hamilton, but I've been in or directed productions of shows like Into the Woods and Chicago and Guys and Dolls and Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and many, many more. Well, and also, I love heavy metal.
So. We've actually now found something that you and I agree on, Jeffrey.
Well, I think with that, we're going to conclude this program. We may not agree on the role of antitrust protecting democracy, but I think we all agree music is great. So on that cheerful note, we'll say goodbye and hope our listeners tune in next week to catch more of our Curious Amalgam.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Our Curious Amalgam, a competition, consumer protection, data protection, and privacy law podcast. It is produced and shared around the globe by ABA's Antitrust Law Section. The opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily represent their employer or other organizations. If you like what you heard or would like to become a member of the American Bar Association, please check out what the Antitrust Section has to offer at ambar.org/antitrust. You can learn more about our podcast at OurCuriousAmalgam.com. If you have comments, suggestions, or podcast ideas, please reach out to us at podcast@OurCuriousAmalgam.com. Until next time, thank you for listening.